No financial relationships, again. I wanted to acknowledge somebody else that has joined us here this morning, Dee Bob, who is an MPH candidate at Long Island University's Brooklyn campus, has been working with me as an intern on some of my other activities. I'm president-elect of the Public Health Association in New York City, and she's been helping me with that, so welcome, Dee. Okay, you heard a lot about what's been happening at the federal level, and now I'm going to talk about what's been happening at the state level. Raising Women's Voices field coordinator Marianne Tomatzik, who's in the back there, and I do a lot of the work with our state-based advocates because this is now moving down into the states. So although it is a national piece of legislation and it was enacted by Congress, the Affordable Care Act actually relies very heavily on states to carry out the key functions of this. And that was a pretty devilish little thing that some of the anti-reform folks did with the Affordable Care Act. You may remember at one time this was going to be a national health insurance plan, and you may remember it was going to have a public option, and it was going to have a lot of things that would have been better than this, but it doesn't. So it's thrown the whole thing out into the states. States are supposed to do some really key things under the Affordable Care Act. It is states that are going to be enrolling people in that expanded Medicaid program that Cindy mentioned that's going to cover millions more people. It is states that are supposed to be enrolling people in those private insurance plans that are supposed to be more affordable when we get federal subsidies. It is a combination of the federal government, HHS, and states that will be setting the standards for those private health insurance plans and choosing which ones will be offered to eligible people. And it is states that will be responsible for conducting outreach and education to communities of people who might be eligible for this insurance. So that's basically a huge chunk of what is supposed to happen under the Affordable Care Act has been thrown out to the states. The way they're supposed to do this is to set up something called a health insurance exchange. And as I go around the country talking with people in states, a lot of them say to me, what the heck is an exchange? What is that? Some people think it means you're going to have to exchange the health insurance you have now for something else. They're just not really sure. Is it a stock exchange? What is it? I sometimes talk about it as like a supermarket for health insurance, or if it's operated well, it'll be something like a Best Buy or a Costco, where you have one big purchaser of health insurance, right, which would be the state exchange, will go out and negotiate with health insurance plans, and the idea is to be sort of like a smart shopper for all of us to get a good price and a good value for health insurance. That's if it's run the proper way, which in some of the states in this country will not be the way it's run. The problem is that this is really a consumer and marketplace model that we're talking about here. It's not a model designed to produce health equity and reproductive justice, to say the least. So it is our challenge to try to figure out how to use this consumer marketplace model to get as close as we can to health equity and reproductive justice. So that's what I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about now. What are some of the key reproductive justice issues in state exchange policy? The first one Amy Allen has already referred to, that states have the option to allow, restrict, or prohibit abortion coverage in health plans offered in the state exchanges. The one bright spot here is if they don't take any action, like if they don't say anything about abortion in establishing their state exchanges, the default is that it is allowed. So you'll see in a few minutes as I talk about what's happened in some of the states, if you can manage to just get the legislation not to say anything about abortion, then it's allowed. Then insurers can decide whether or not to cover it. Second issue, will there be enough reproductive health providers in the provider networks of those plans that we're going to be enrolling in? Third, will women be able to easily find out which plans cover abortion, which don't, and which include their trusted providers? It's a challenge. Will the plan information and services be culturally competent and address health disparities? That's another big challenge. And lastly, I think it's important to recognize that insurer and provider refusals, those conscience clauses we've been hearing a lot about, or biased information, like refusing to tell you about all your options, refusing to tell you which plans cover abortion, which don't, that could obstruct access as well. The state exchange process should be speeding ahead. It's not speeding ahead generally. It's sped out in those 11 states, but it's kind of limping along in some others. States have to do this really fast. I mean, in bureaucratic years, they've got like 3 seconds left to establish these exchanges.
Dog life, yeah.
By January 2013, HHS is going to go around and look, how are they doing? Did they set it up? Does it look like it's going to happen? And if not, the federal government is supposed to take it over and run it. But recently, HHS said to itself, oh no, we don't have to run all those. So they're putting out some idea about, well, it could be a state and federal partnership, maybe we could help you. We'll see, it's all emerging at the moment. The thing is, those exchanges are supposed to be ready to begin screening all of us for eligibility for either expanded Medicaid or these plans by the fall of 2013. That's only 2 years from now. And the exchange is actually officially open January 2014. So here's a map from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities that shows you how the state exchange legislation fared. And if you can't read it, all the legend and everything, let me just say that the states with the dark blue are the ones that actually have established exchanges, either through legislation or, in the case of Rhode Island, through an executive order. The ones in sort of a weird yellow color passed legislation that said, well, we intend to have an exchange, we're thinking about it, we're going to study it some more. So they didn't actually get there. The ones in gray, no legislation. I mean, it failed this year. The ones in white didn't even bother to introduce any legislation. And the ones in light blue says it's still pending, but it's really too late. It's not going to pass this year. So you can see that it's really a minority of states that actually have established it so far. So Amy mentioned a little bit that basically we have a group of pro-choice, pro-health reform states that have established their exchanges and have not banned abortion coverage. In Rhode Island, I mentioned the governor had to issue an executive order to create the exchange. That's because the legislation got stuck in the legislature when an anti-abortion coverage amendment was attached to it. And they couldn't get it off, and the governor, Lincoln Chafee, who's pro-choice, didn't want to have to sign that, so they just didn't do it. And he recently issued an executive order. It remains to be seen whether he can accomplish all that needs to be done with the executive order. In West Virginia, we were working with a group called West Virginia Free, which is our coordinator in West Virginia, and they faced a real problem. I see I didn't finish my sentence here, but I'll finish it for you now. The Health Reform Coalition in West Virginia had, okay, reproductive justice advocates, West Virginia Free, yay, they managed to get their way on to the leadership of the Health Reform Coalition. But also there was the Catholic Conference. So what they did was come to an agreement, sort of a truce, because the Catholic Conference wanted to get the exchange set up for other reasons. I mean, Catholic hospitals do want poor people to have health insurance, right? And Catholic Charities does, and the group, Catholics in general, want people to get health insurance. So that greater good overrode their desire to insist that there be abortion ban. Instead, they just had a silence is golden policy. Remember I said if the legislation doesn't explicitly prohibit abortion, then the default is it's allowed. So that's what's happened in West Virginia. However, they're only still at the start of the process in all these states, so there's going to be other chances for the Catholic Conference to come back and try to prohibit it. Then you have those anti-choice, anti-reform states. And really, of the states that have enacted the restrictions, almost all of them are either suing to block the health reform law, you know, those cases that are going to come before the Supreme Court in 2012, or they're publicly resisting creating the state exchanges, like Kansas recently. I'm sure Kathleen Sebelius was horrified at this as the former insurance commissioner for the state of Kansas. Kansas gave back its money to the federal government that it had received to set up an exchange. They just said, no, we're not having anything to do with Obamacare. And they gave the money back. Anybody here live in Kansas? Oh dear, we have to help them out. Rest of the states, there's major states like New York, where I'm from, and Illinois, that are working really hard behind the scenes on doing the infrastructure that's needed to set up an exchange. But have yet to legislatively create an exchange for various reasons. And then we have states like Arkansas and New Mexico that had bad political disputes that prevented the exchange establishment. Arkansas was one of those ones where an abortion restriction got attached to the exchange legislation, and it looked like it was going to move forward, but then the folks we worked with out there at the Planned Parenthood managed to get an amendment to the abortion ban attached that allowed a health exception. And that was so unbelievably unacceptable to the anti-choice sponsors that they refused to move the bill. So they just didn't do health reform because they didn't want to have a health exception in their abortion ban. Some of the states are just waiting around to see what's going to happen. They're hoping that Obama loses or the Supreme Court overturns it or something. So meanwhile, we're doing all that work out in the states. HHS, over the summer, issued proposed regulations that would govern how states go about setting up these exchanges. And there's a few copies in the back. I don't know whether anybody else wants one. I have a few here, if you want mine afterwards. We decided Raising Women's Voices needed to look at those regulations, right, because they're going to influence what happens out in the states. But we didn't want to just sit around and talk to each other. Instead, we did what Raising Women's Voices always does, which is to go out and ask women and health providers, what do we need these to say? So we convened 6 national conference calls in August and September, and came up with some very detailed comments. I'm going to give you a few highlights from them. Several of us also went to HHS had these things called listening sessions, where they sent their top officials to listen to us. I went to the one in New York, and two of our coordinators went to the one in Chicago. And we heard an official from HHS say that the exchange websites, here's her goal for them. She would like them to be like shopping for shoes on Zappos.com. That it will be that easy. Just really easy. You just go on and you figure out what you want and buy your health insurance. So I got up and said, well, when you're buying shoes at Zappos, all you need to care about is the color of the shoes, the size of the shoes, the style, and the price. That's 4 things.
And you can send them back.
And you can send them back.
Free.
You're right. Isn't it a little bit more complicated? Do we really want Zappos.com as our model? So we came up with some much more detailed comments. All right. Here are some of the things we're paying attention to, both in these HHS comments and out in the states now where they're setting up these exchanges. We have to get seats at the table because they're going to have this big conversation that's going to affect the healthcare for millions of women and our families, and we need to be there. So we're working hard to get representation of women, women of color, low-income women, as many different kinds of women as we can on exchange boards. And they're going to have these stakeholder advisory boards in a number of states that will provide advice to the exchange board. We're also trying hard to rule out, through regulations, exchange board members who come from the insurance industry or from anti-choice, anti-reform groups. In the state of Colorado, they've already appointed their exchange board that has four people from the health insurance industry on it. Not so good. The HHS regulations actually would make that a no-no. No insurance company people on exchange boards. We'll see what happens once HHS issues the regulations. A good model of how to do it right is the Maryland Women's Coalition for Health Reform. Anybody here from that group this morning? No, they're probably doing another panel. They help set the appointment standards for the board to ensure inclusion of someone with public health expertise. They did that instead of saying women's health expertise or reproductive health expertise, which they thought, uh-oh, they might not be able to get that. They said public health expertise. Smart, huh? I think it's going to work. They recruited exchange board candidates. They actually held interviews with a number of people and decided whether they liked them or not, and then they nominated people to the exchange board, and they actually got three of their people appointed. And they've got appointments on a number of the exchange advisory boards. So they're showing the way how to do it in Maryland. We also want to influence the eligibility and enrollment processes of these exchanges. We all know that women cycle in and out of the workforce and on and off Medicaid. We're going to be the ones going back and forth between this expanded Medicaid program and these subsidized private insurance plans. We want to make sure that you can do that easily, that you don't sort of fall off the grid when you lose eligibility for one portion of this and need to move to another. We also want to make sure that we can get in-person help from these navigators that are supposed to be funded through the exchanges. Remember the website thing, the Zappos.com? We all know it's not going to be like buying shoes on Zappos. So we need to make sure that there's call centers that are open all kinds of hours late at night. You know, like after you put the kids to bed, you could actually get on the phone and call somebody and ask some questions, have it open on the weekend. And then we want in-person help. People who can speak our language, people who understand the needs of women and our families, people who are unbiased about reproductive health coverage. Imagine if we have Catholic Charities serving as a navigator. What will they tell people about health insurance? Focus on the family. You know, some of the evangelical churches, they could try to become navigators, and then the information that women would be getting wouldn't be too complete. We also want to allow women to disenroll from plans that don't cover our reproductive health care needs. Not only might a woman get in there inadvertently because she couldn't get the right information, but there's also a provision that allows for auto-enrollment of women in plans if they don't make a choice within a certain period of time. And a lot of us have had experience with that in Medicaid managed care, where you try to, you know, help a woman make a decision about what plan to be in, but she's overwhelmed by crises in the family, and so she doesn't enroll, and then she gets automatically enrolled into a Catholic healthcare plan that doesn't cover the services she needs. So we need to allow her to be able to disenroll. We need to set standards for what QHPs, those are qualified health plans. Those are the private health plans that are going to be in these exchanges. We, for example, we want them to have sufficient numbers of essential community providers, such as reproductive health providers and federally qualified health centers. We want to allow people to go out of the provider network at no extra cost for services that they can't quickly get from in-network providers. Like, suppose there's no abortion providers for five counties. Nobody could be in the plan. We want them to be able to go someplace else. We want plans to collect and provide data on the claims that they deny based on the race of the person, the gender of the person, and the type of procedure denied. So we can find out, are there certain plans that are denying all kinds of claims for reproductive health care? We want them to collect that information and make it available. And then we could use that in subsequent years to decide which are the plans we think women should enroll in and which ones treat women terribly. And so we shouldn't encourage women to enroll in those. We want a sufficient number of providers who speak languages other than English. and we want people to speak in plain English when they do speak English. Also translation services and materials in other languages. How can we use these exchanges? Remember the consumer marketplace model. How are we going to try to shape it to achieve health equity? We want those governing board members and stakeholder advisory board members to be diverse. We want them to include gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity in the list of factors that are linked to health disparities. Often they just focus on race, ethnicity, and class. We want them to recognize the intersections of all these issues, that you could be a woman of color, you could be a lesbian woman of color, right? And you would fit in a whole bunch of different categories, but the way they've got it set up, it might silo people. We want exchange boards to develop specific plans about how they're going to use this tremendous new insurance opportunity to reduce health disparities. We want data collection and tracking of health outcomes to assess progress. And one that I just picked up and actually didn't get into our exchange comments, but a colleague from Lambda Legal pointed this out to me the other day. We need to ensure that family, the word family, is broadly defined in all aspects of exchange policy so that it will include same-sex partners, will include families that are made are a woman-headed household, but maybe there's a guy in the household who's not officially part of the family. We need to really take a look at family. So Raising Women's Voices is on the ground in a number of states. We have coordinators. We used to have 22 coordinators in 20 states. Now we have 21 coordinators in 19 states because our coordinator in Chicago, Black Women for Reproductive Justice, fabulous group, has just announced that it's folding. Yeah, after 15 years. And we're very, very sad to see them do that. They just couldn't get enough support to keep going, financial support. If any of you are from Chicago or know somebody from Chicago who could step in to fill that gap, we really could use someone. You know, we can't completely replace what Black Women for Reproductive Justice brought to that conversation, but we really need some help there. We're actively engaged in influencing the exchange development or fighting anti-reform, anti-choice policies in mixed or conservative states. We provide our coordinators with technical assistance, regular phone calls, mini grants, all kinds of support. So if you know somebody who might want to be a coordinator, if you want to be a coordinator, Marianne Tomacic in the back row there, raise your hand, Marianne, is our field coordinator. Go see her afterwards. We'd love to have you join us. Thank you.